Chapter 67. The monarch landed with an incredible amount of grace, considering that she had the length and beam of a World War II destroyer. She'd come in slowly, extending large flaps and dropping to a position just above the water, where the high-pressure cavitation system was engaged. With a cushion of air to break up the surface tension, the plane had landed smoothly, the central spine of its keel cleaving the water in two. Only when the speed dropped below 40 knots was the cavitation system shut down. By then, the entire lower fuselage of the aircraft had been cradled by the sea, and the monarch was settling gently. It eased to a crawl and stopped near where the Griffin had been destroyed, but nearly a mile from the wreck site. Tessa left the cockpit. "I'll be on the lower deck," she said. "Keep the engines turning. I want to be able to leave here at a moment's notice." The pilots responded in unison, and Tessa left them behind, racing to the bottom deck and heading aft. She arrived to find the tail ramp already lowered and Volk and Woods working together to get the recovery teams into the water. The disc-shaped submersible was lowered first, followed by a slower, bulkier sub, which her people called the bus. Volk was in the discus. Woods drove the bus. Behind them, two high-speed boats were launched, each with four divers aboard. The group in the first boat were commercial divers Woods had rounded up. The group in the second boat were the remnants of the mercenaries Volk had hired. He called them the Predator Team. Tessa intended to keep in contact with all of them. She put on a headset with noise-dampening ear cups so she could hear over the continued whistle of the engines. After plugging the jack into the transmitter, she moved the microphone in front of her mouth. "How long will this take?" "No time at all," Volk insisted. "The depth is 120 feet. The vessel seems to be intact, and this time we know what we're looking for." "Get it, and get back here," she said. "Austin may have called for help. We might not have a lot of time." Volk gripped the controls of his submersible. It felt good to be back in control again. "Woods, are your men ready?" Volk didn't trust Woods. Even with the threat of death, the man was a fanatic. When told they'd be recovering the antidote, Woods had been furious. He wanted it destroyed, claiming it could only lead the world back to the oil age. Tessa had had to explain again that their lives were worthless without the antidote. Then Woods had finally come around. Still, Volk and Tessa had agreed to keep a close eye on him and use him only when absolutely necessary. "They're ready," Woods said. "Tell them to follow me down. We don't have time to wait for you." Volk engaged his propulsion jets and the discus began crossing the water toward the wreck site. The power boats passed him, one to either side, while the bus trailed well behind. Reaching the dive coordinates, Volk turned a valve and flooded his ballast tank. The discus submerged and began dropping toward the bottom. The commercial divers went in the water, swimming beside him in a steady descent. Volk spotted the Minerve and approached it from the broadside, noticing the opening that had been cut in it. "Numa's already been down here," he reported. "I only hope the counteragent wasn't on board their vessel when we blew it apart." "They wouldn't have been sitting around if they had it," Tessa insisted. "It's down there." Volk looked around. It dawned on him that some of the Numa personnel might have been in the water when they attacked the Griffin. He doubted a lone diver or even a group of them would be brazen enough to attack his men, not when it would be far wiser to swim away and call for help. But he put nothing past these men and women from Numa. "Group one, take up positions on the hull where you can watch for trouble. Group two, get inside and see what you can find." As the divers swam to their new positions, Volk backed away from the submarine, giving himself a wider view. He watched as the two men swam up to the opening and shined their lights inside. "Looks like the control room," one of them reported. €100,000 to whoever finds the canister," Volk said. The first diver went in, disconnecting the small air tank from his dive harness and pushing it in front of him. "I'm going aft." He knew he had the best chance of finding the canister. He'd been part of the team that found the oil destroyer in the Dakar, and he would know the canisters by sight. The Israelis had stored them in a refrigerated compartment meant for food. Why, he didn't know, but he expected the French would do the same. He went aft, heading for the galley, came to a bulkhead door and found it chained in the open position. He grabbed the door and shook it, interested in whether it would even move at this point. As he did so, his light illuminated the skeletal remains of a crewman stuck behind the door. He pulled back instantly, exhaling a cloud of bubbles. It wasn't fear, just shock, made worse by the adrenaline and the high level of oxygen running through his body. Waiting for his heart rate to slow, he drifted backward and bumped into something. Spinning around, he saw a metallic monster, bulbous and grotesque, with copper-colored skin. He saw his own reflection in the curved glass of the huge head. Far too late, he noticed a weighty arm crashing down toward him. The metal fist slammed into his skull and knocked him out cold. The second diver had entered the open space of the submarine's control room, saw the lead diver going aft, and turned toward the forward part of the sub. He swam past the periscope housing and through the forward hatchway door. Like the other doors, this one was chained in the open position. Confidently, he kicked smoothly and entered the compartment, moving methodically and removing his tank as the first diver had. He went one compartment at a time, shining his light in every nook. He'd reached the forward torpedo room when a strange sound reached his ears. Sizzling, bubbling, burning is how he would have described it. He looked around for the source of that noise, noticed a glow coming from far behind him and turned, swimming back toward the control room. He kicked harder and faster as he neared the hatch, a supernatural sense of danger driving him forward. Getting closer, he saw a jet of fire lighting up the hatchway. He quickly realized it was a cutting torch. He swam for the gap, caught sight of a diver in a bulky ADS on the far side, and then realized what was happening. The armored diver was cutting the chain that held the hatch open. The links were severed, the chain dropped to the deck, and the hatch began to swing closed. The diver shoved his air tank forward and wedged it in the gap, momentarily preventing the closure. The hatch rebounded open, and he tried to swim through. It was not to be. The diver in the ADS blocked him and grabbed at his face with the metallic arms. The diver pulled back, only to have his helmet ripped off his head. Bubbles exploded in all directions, and the world was instantly blurred. All he could see were indistinct shapes and shadows moving around as his dive light bounced loose. He grabbed for his backup regulator, got it into his mouth, and took a desperate breath. Before he could do anything more, a resounding metallic clang told him his fate had been sealed. The hatch door had been slammed shut, the wheel turned and locked. He grabbed the handle and tried to twist it. His only hope lay with the other divers still outside of the submarine. But without his helmet, he couldn't even call for help. Paul stood beside the sealed hatchway. He'd knocked one foe into unconsciousness with a single blow and sealed the second one in the forward part of the hull, after removing his helmet with its communication system. He moved back in the other direction, spotting Gamay as she emerged from the aft section of the submarine, dragging the banded steel cylinder behind her. It was partially encrusted with salts and rust, but identifiable as the canister they were after. "You found it?"
"I did," Gamay said. "Now we have to get out of here."
"That's going to be a challenge," she said, pointing at the man he'd knocked out. "This guy wanted to join you in the mess hall."
"How did they not see you?"
"I hid on the ceiling," Paul said. "They swam right underneath me."
"What happened to the other diver?"
"He went forward. I locked him in. But I'm pretty sure they're not alone."
Gamay twisted, exhaling a stream of bubbles. "We're trapped."
Paul nodded inside the suit. "Unless we get some assistance to break the blockade, this submarine is going to be our Alamo."
Waiting outside the Minerve, Volk drummed his fingers on the control panel. The delay soon became too much for him.
"Divers, report! What's going on in there?"
Wreck diving was dangerous business, but the Minerve was in such good condition it was doubtful his people faced the kind of dangers usually associated with sunken ships. With no response forthcoming, Volk's frustration grew. Underwater radios were not that reliable. It was possible the hull of the submarine was blocking the signal. Team 2, get in there and find out what's going on, he said. Stick together. The second pair of divers moved toward the hull, reaching the opening and entering more cautiously. Almost immediately, Volk knew something had gone wrong. A wave of bubbles exploded through the gap in the hull, and the beams from divers' hand lights could be seen dancing around chaotically. They're in here, a shout came over the radio. Get out, the other diver shouted. Get out! One of the men burst from the opening, swimming hard. The second diver was halfway out when he was grabbed by a large metallic arm, which clamped down on his leg, raking his calf and drawing blood. He squirmed and twisted, shouting as his ankle snapped and the fin was ripped from his foot. With another kick, he pulled free and went right for the surface. Two members of the Numa team are in there, the first diver reported. One in regular gear and one in a hard suit. A moment later, the diver in the hard suit emerged from the opening, the suit's huge shoulders barely fitting through. Volk instinctively attacked, pushing the throttle of his vessel to full. As the discus sped forward, the pincers at the front opened wide, targeting the diver's helmeted head. But the armored figure dropped back into the Minerve and hid before Volk could hit him. Volk pulled up, crossed over the top of the submarine, and spun his vessel around. This time he set up closer to the opening, ready to hammer anything that emerged. Back on the surface, Tessa heard the radio chatter. Through a set of binoculars, she saw one of her scuba divers popping to the surface. He was bleeding and swimming for one of the dive boats. A radio call from Volk arrived next. They're down here, at least two of them. We have them trapped in the Minerve, but we can't get inside. She pressed the transmitter. Don't let them escape. That's not what they're trying to do, Volk replied. This is obviously a delaying tactic. The longer we stay, the more likely help is to arrive. Help is coming, she insisted, but not for them. She contacted the second team of divers, the Predator team who were used to fighting and killing. You're needed, she said. Go. They went in the water one after another, four men carrying spear guns with explosives tipped heads.